This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
So today we're talking about the origins of band names, and we're talking about artists and celebrities who take themselves too seriously. But certainly when we were growing up, that wasn't the case. It was clear from the band names that were out there a lot of the times. You had bands that called themselves things like Toad the Wet Sprocket, which, you know, well, exactly. I mean, the thing is I do vaguely recall the name, but I wouldn't be able to tell you what they sing. They're best known for this 1992, and I put this in air quotes, hit, which is called All I Want. Maybe the Jimmy Kimmel of bands.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a wet sprocket. I don't even know what a wet sprocket is, but that song sounds like one.
It definitely fits.
Is that from like a montage of a really poor 80s rom-com?
Like, that sounds like the background music to like a conversation on a train between two people in a TV show. A daytime TV show at that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just so instantly forgettable.
Dawson's Creek style.
Yeah, like I could barely decipher a chord change there. I was just strumming.
Yeah. Perhaps the most interesting thing about them is actually how they got their name. They took it from a Monty Python sketch that's called Rock Notes.
God, of course they did.
In which a journalist delivers this nonsensical music news report. But why was Toad the Wet Sprocket in the sketch in the first place? What did it mean? The Python member Eric Idle explains the whole story.
I once wrote a sketch about rock musicians, and I was trying to think of a name that would be so silly nobody would ever use it or dream it could ever be used. So I wrote the words, Toad the Wet Sprocket. And a few years later, I was driving along the freeway in LA, and a song came on the radio, and the DJ said, that was by Toad the Wet Sprocket. And I nearly drove off the freeway. So here's the original bit. It's called Rock Notes. And it went something like this. Rex Stardust, lead electric triangle with Toad the Wet Sprocket, has had to have an elbow removed following their recent successful worldwide tour of Finland.
Here's the thing. If you call yourselves Toad the Wet Sprocket, you're essentially accepting a lifetime of mediocrity because you're never going to headline a massive stadium if you're called Toad the Wet Sprocket. You've got to call yourself something like Queen or Nirvana or Oasis or something... Punchy. Magisterial.
Yeah, yes. With this only one word.
Yeah.
Ideally.
Yeah.
Can one you imagine, or two words max.
Have you heard who's headlining Glastonbury this year? That's Toad the Wet Sprocket.
Yeah, exactly.
I've already got my ticket.
The thing is, their first gig was approaching. They hadn't chosen a name yet, still relatively new. They had to come up with something. And it's funny, as I was looking into this today, how often that's the case. They got together, they're playing music, they haven't really picked a name. All of a sudden, there's a time pressure in which they need to come up with something. And they just reach.
Yeah.
So many bands just reach for whatever is just right in front of them. And in this case, they, I guess, thought this Monty Python sketch was really funny. And they took on Toad the Wet Sprocket because they thought it would be hilarious. And the vocalist of the group, a guy by the name of Glenn Phillips, said it was a joke that went on too long.
In other words, their lifespan as a band went on too long is what he was saying. It's still better than Nickelback and that horrendous story about getting a Nickelback at the dime store every time. It's still better than that.
That might be the worst band name origin story that we've heard so far. But let's move on to another one.
Now, I note that Pearl Jam has never featured on Living on a Prayer. And, Rog, I'd just like to say to you, I'm eternally grateful for that fact. Thank you very much.
Have you
Grunge
thought about
Godfathers.
Have you considered featuring Pearl Jam? Has that come up?
No, I haven't.
Not a fan.
We are running out of options, so we probably should.
This Wednesday, an exclusive as we delve into the career of Pearl Jam.
You know when we have a Living on a Prayer and we're featuring Pearl Jam that we've officially hit rock bottom.
That is what the barrel sounds like.
Yeah, we don't know how much longer Oscar will continue after that point. We'll see what happens. But Eddie Vedder, of course, the frontman, and his band were originally known as the Mookie Blaylock, which was a reference to an NBA point guard who had played with a number of different teams, the Nets, Hawks, Warriors. Apparently, they had a couple basketball cards that they were collecting, and they're, you know, kind of getting ready for their first gig. They need a name, and they happened to come across Mookie's. Is it Mookie or Mookie? Anyways, Mookie's card. And so initially they're like, well, we need a name. Let's call ourselves Mookie Blaylock.
Oh,
so that
man.
Was the name of the band initially. Eventually they kind of changed their name up. Unlike Toad the Wet Sprocket, they didn't just stick with that.
Yeah.
But even after they got famous as Pearl Jam, the reason for that story is something that Eddie Vedder, it seems like he came up with this absolutely bogus story to troll people with.
Right.
But let us know what you think of it.
A great grandma, and her name is Pearl, and she was at one time married to an Indian chief who, in a wonderful crossing of cultures, she integrated some of his into some of hers, and it was this hallucinogenic jam. It was great grandma Pearl's jam.
So he says, probably completely facetiously, that his great-grandma Pearl had a hallucinogenic jam that she would whip up in the kitchen, and therefore Pearl's jam.
So it wasn't about jamming in the garage, you know.
With a drum kit, which just happens to have Pearl written on the front skin. I've always assumed that. I think he's over-romanticizing.
He's
making it too mystical.
I have a feeling they've just been asked. They're like teenagers at this point, aren't they?
Yeah.
And he's just kind of come up with a bit of a wild story. Anyways, the real story, according to bassist Jeff Ament, is that he had suggested the name Pearl. Unclear why he came up with that, but the idea of it being on the drum kit seems to make a lot of sense. And then apparently the group attended a Neil Young show that had a lot of jams. And so they came up with Pearl Jam. Anyways, though they had changed their name from Mookie Blaylock, they still had a bit of a tribute to him.
Goodness,
from one dreadful effort to another.
Yeah, exactly. Their debut album was 10, which was his jersey number.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, and there was a whole meet and greet years later between Jeff and Mookie where they kind of talk about it and they're like shooting hoops together. It's sweet. It's really sweet.
If you could only listen to Pearl Jam or Nickelback for the rest of your life.
I mean, there's no question I'm taking Pearl Jam all day.
I don't know.
You're taking Nickelback over Pearl Jam? Come on, they're not that offensive.
Oh, I'm not a fan.
Yeah, but between Pearl Jam and Nickelback?
Okay, well,
maybe we need to play some Nickelback for Rob to remind him.
Maybe. Maybe.
Just how bad it is.
Yeah,
all right, here's one that I assume Raj is a fan of.
This has featured on Living on a Prayer.
It has, definitely.
Yeah, I think you might even have done two albums by this band. You've definitely done OK Computer.
OK Computer,
yeah,
I remember.
Yeah, definitely did OK Computer. I think we've touched on them in other features as well, maybe, when we did the Glorious Rock Friday.
Yeah, so we are fans. I'm not the biggest fan, personally. They don't really float my boat, but I understand that they're very respected by music lovers. They formed in 1985, initially called themselves On a Friday. The reason being is that their usual rehearsal day in their school's music room was, you guessed On a Friday. So that was their first name. But by the time they started putting demos out and they were playing gigs, I mean, they were picked up early on. They didn't need to fight for the record deal. They were swept up, basically. They got this record deal with EMI, who were like, change the name.
Yeah, really?
So they did.
Really?
And they took their inspiration from a song on a Talking Heads 1986 album called True Stories.
Okay.
They named their band after another band's song.
Yeah.
So a lot of heads involved here.
A lot of heads. Indeed.
A lot of heads involved here.
And Radioheads.
Tom York said the name sums up all these things about receiving stuff. It's about the way you take information in, the way you respond to the environment you're put in. I think that's making a little too much of it personally, but that's what he says.
Does it need to be that deep?
I mean, of course, I think when it's Tom York, it does need to be that deep.
Yeah,
doesn't
everything
it?
Has to be that
deep.
As for Talking Heads, though, they were originally the Artistics. Talking Heads is so much better, isn't it? Yeah. They played their first gig as Talking Heads when they were opening for the Ramones back in 1975. And according to a member of the band, the name came to them when they were looking at an issue of a TV guide, which explained the term that was used by TV studios to describe this kind of head and shoulder shot of a person who's just talking to the camera, right? all content, no action, essentially, is what it said. And so we still say talking heads, right?
When you're
watching a documentary,
yeah.
That piece to camera where somebody's just talking straight at the camera is a talking head.
Yep.
And so they saw that in a TV guide and thought, that's cool.
Yeah.
Let's roll with that.
I like talking heads as a name. I think it's a good one.
Mm. Let's move on now to this one. Because maybe you're gonna be the one that saves me. And after all, I have to admit, I didn't know much about the formation of Oasis. I didn't realize initially it was Liam who was in the band.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that time, it was known as Rain, not as Oasis. But when they were starting to play clubs, Liam thought, oh, it's going to be a stronger band if Noel's going to join.
Since he's going to write all the songs.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
No chance before then.
But I think you can tell how sort of tumultuous this is going to be from the very earliest stories, right? Because he invites him down to one of their gigs. Liam's like, hey, Noel, come check it out. We're playing a gig. And according to the book, Oasis, The Truth, which has a very heavy title to it, when Liam goes to have a chat with Noel after the show, he's like, hey, man, what'd you think? And Noel apparently replies, bleeping bleep.
Oh.
Yeah. So Liam was a bit disheartened, a bit deflated. And then a friend comes around to tell him Noel had totally been engrossed. He was like loving it.
Oh. So big brother.
Exactly.
Not wanting to give away his secrets.
Not showing all his cards in that situation.
Exactly, yeah.
And then it seems that Noel definitely saw some of the potential in the band. And there was a bit of jocular kind of stories going around about how it all happened. Because Noel said, listen, I never set out to take over the band. And Liam said Noel came to him in tears, begging on his hands and knees to join. So yeah, different stories, I'm sure, circulating when it comes to those two. So how did they settle on a name, starting with Rain, that was inspired by the Oasis Leisure Centre in Swindon?
Oh my God, are you kidding me?
Yeah. They had decided to change the name from Rain, and Liam is, you know, in Noel's room. He sees a concert poster on the wall. It turned out Noel had been roadieing for the Inspiral Carpets.
Inspiral Carpets. He was the guitar tech.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then the venue on the concert poster that he had kind of grabbed with him was for the Oasis Leisure Centre in Swindon. And so he sees this poster. He thinks it's a cool poster. And therefore,
oh
you have
my
Oasis.
God. I did not expect Swindon to be the birthplace of the band name Oasis.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Well, how about one of my own favorites?
Yes.
I mean, it's the music is utterly ridiculous, but how can you not love it? You know, it's fun. Anyways, Darius Rucker.
It's called the edge of a Pearl Jam. I'll give it that.
Wow.
So you're listening to a whole Hootie album before you're listening to a whole Pearl Jam album is what you're telling me. Wow. I'm impressed by that. I'm surprised and impressed. Darius Rucker, everybody assumes the frontman of this band is Hootie. That is obviously not the case. And certainly the other guys in the band are not the Blowfish. That is not what this is about. The band apparently refers to two of his friends, Darius's friends, that is. When he was attending the University of South Carolina, as the story goes, one of his friends wore these big glasses. He looked a bit like an owl. And the other friend had really puffy cheeks. So one day, and this is like the start of a bad joke, the two once walk into a party and Rucker calls out, it's Hootie and the Blowfish.
Wow.
And so a self-referential kind of callback to his own bad joke.
Yeah.
He called his band that he's known for decades, Hootie and the Blowfish.
I mean, that is an appropriate backstory for the band and the music that they produce.
What are you trying to say?
A statement that should never have been uttered becomes set in stone, forevermore immortalized by the existence of a band.
The Off-Script Podcast.
From the team that brought you The Man That Could Not Be Interviewed with Steven Seagal.
Let's just get it over with.
This is Behind the Scenes, coming to a radio near you now.
We are talking a major winner at the Oscars.
We are a guy that's, well, his film has walked on with 7 out of 13 nominations. What a weekend. On Friday, he was awarded the Prosca posthumously for Memento, which we invented. And then he swept up at the Oscars in just 2 days. This is the making of the man that Steven Spielberg has described as a craftsman of the highest order. If Steven Spielberg's saying that about you, you're doing pretty well. And then Quentin Tarantino has hailed this guy as one of the few directors capable of making original blockbusters. blockbusters. We're talking, of course, about this fella.
And the Oscar goes to Christopher Nolan Oppenheimer.
This is the first Oscar win and eighth nomination for Christopher Nolan. He received his first nomination for his Memento screenplay.
Yeah.
This was his first win.
First win. Ooh. Yeah.
Surprised by that.
Yeah, he won big this morning, I'll say. It was kind of last night, wasn't it? He's a visionary, certainly for his generation, as big as someone like Scorsese was for his generation, or Spielberg was for his generation, kind of pushing what cinema as a genre can do. Famous for having meticulous attention to detail, but also being a bit relaxed about everything as well, and not being too meticulous. Constantly asking what can he do with the latest technology, whilst not being afraid to make films that are so far away from the mainstream, with massive actors on huge budgets, which is a pretty risky strategy. It's worked well for him over the years. He's kind of snowballed.
And he seems to be a real sort of big thinker, doesn't he? And
yeah.
In articles I've read where he's speaking, I really struggle sometimes to understand some of the concepts that he's talking about.
Yeah.
I think he's an abstract thinker. If his movies are abstract, I think that's just how he runs his
him.
Life. Yeah,
yeah
that's
yeah.
just who he is.
Yeah, absolutely. Really interesting character. Born in 1970 in Westminster in London, fascinated with filmmaking and also fascinated with books and reading and stories. His hobby was to use his father's Super 8mm film camera to tell those stories. And that's kind of your origin story. But he has all the ticks of a supervillain when he's on set. So when he's developing a film, he'll go to the prospective actors with a physical copy of the script and sit with them as they read the script for the first time and then ask what they think. Do you want to be in it?
That is so
How
intimidating.
Weird is that?
Yeah.
That is super weird. Imagine being an actor and somebody's just sitting in the room watching you while you spend 3 hours going through sort of 100 pages worth of...
I'm a really slow reader.
Yeah,
I'd be so conscious of that. I wouldn't be paying attention to what I'm reading.
Yeah, you just feel his eyes
boring
into you.
You'd have to laugh nervously at what you thought was the joke.
Yeah. Was that a joke? Yeah, absolutely. He prints scripts in red and black ink mix so that they can't be copied, or if they are copied, then he'll know that they've been copied.
Oh.
It kind of encourages that. And he doesn't have email or a smartphone. He has what you would call like a burner phone.
A pager?
Yeah. A pager, yeah, like a little old Nokia.
Like a dumb phone.
Yeah, exactly. And he doesn't allow Ugg boots on set.
What?
No idea why.
Who has offended him with Ugg boots before?
Exactly. Who hurt you?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, he has a genuine love of film and he puts that love into his work. Here he is talking about what he hopes it means to people when they see his name in association with a film.
I hope it means a commitment to the technical side of the film and to the creative side that we're trying to make the best film possible. So I suppose really, I mean, I've always said sincerity is the key thing with a filmmaker. Like if you go to see a film and if you think that the people who made that film have genuinely made the best film that they possibly can,
right,
then I don't feel I've wasted my time, no matter what the film is, no matter how it is. And so I would certainly want people to expect that and trust that from me, that, you know, whether the film's good or bad or indifferent is up for other people to say, but I want people to know that I've gone to the mat for the film and we've done the best we possibly can.
He's hinted at something we're going to talk about a lot, though. Collaboration. There's two really important collaborators. Joel Nolan is his brother, who has written so many of his features. Memento, the first one that got the screenplay nomination, and then The Prestige, The Dark Knight, The Dark Knight Rises, and Interstellar. So he always keeps Jonathan, as he's known, but Joan is kind of the nickname. 6 years his junior. Always keeps him in and around the writing process, and they clearly click because they write some pretty impressive stuff together. But also Christopher Nolan's wife, Emma Thomas is her name. They married in 1997. That was about the same time they were working on Christopher Nolan's first film, which was called Following, which came out in 1998. And ever since then, Emma has not only been Christopher Nolan's wife, but she has produced every single one of his films. And they also have 4 kids together. So that's a pretty strong marriage. You know, that this the industry is not great for relationships, but they've kind of gone through it together. It's kind of a mark of, you know, their success together, which I think is pretty good. And like I said, so we'll keep coming back to collaboration. It keeps cropping up again and again with the same names he likes to work with. So between 1997 to 2002, he establishes working relationships with his brother and his wife. They produce a few short films and then two films, The Following and Memento, that gained widespread industry
support. One of them won a Proscar.
One of them won a Proscar. I mean, this is peak for his career. But yeah, the Oscar nomination.
I wonder if he knows of that honor.
We should let him
we
know.
We should send him a little
Proscar. We don't have any goodie bags for him, unfortunately. Yeah.
We can't email him either. He hasn't got an email. So I don't know how we'll get in touch. But yeah, it was 2005 when Christopher Nolan kind of catapulted into the cinematic stratosphere with, of course, Batman Begins for DC Studios, literally saving the Gotham City legend.
I wanted to save Gotham. I failed.
Why do we force? So that we can learn to pick ourselves up.
I do not envy anybody else after Christopher Nolan trying to make a Batman film.
No, he's changed the game.
Yeah.
He's absolutely changed
the
game.
That Robert Pattinson one actually was better than I expected. I thought it was all right. Yeah. It was pretty good considering.
But it continued those themes, didn't it? It kind of continued that.
It just doesn't compete, though.
No, it doesn't compete. And the reboot of the Batman franchise not only revitalized the Caped Crusader, but solidifies Nolan's reputation as a director capable of seamlessly blending blockbuster entertainment with intellectual depth. I can't believe this. The trilogy grossed $2.5 billion. Billion dollars. Unbelievable.
They reckon it actually, that trilogy was not just responsible for revitalizing Batman, but actually giving Hollywood an obsession with superhero movies, which lasted a full decade.
Yeah, I mean, we're only really coming to the end of it now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Mercifully. So we shouldn't actually be thanking Christopher Nolan because.
Look, those three were good. Those three were good.
They were.
If you'd have left it there, it would have been fine. But you're right.
It's just a bit of a legacy. 97 that followed it that were slight overkill.
Yeah, you're right. But it transcended the superhero genre. It earned Heath Ledger a posthumous Academy Award for his iconic portrayal of the Joker. And it was kind of a match made in heaven between director and actor. They're both so dedicated to the process. Here's a clip. It's Christopher Nolan talking about working with Heath Ledger in developing that iconic character. Excuse the music on this clip. It's from a behind the scenes of a DVD extra, but it gets the point across.
Heath was somebody I'd met with over the years for different roles. Indeed, I'd met him for Batman at the same time as I met, you know, every actor in town. He explained why he didn't want to do something like that. He was very polite about it. But we saw absolutely eye to eye on who this guy was going to be. We talked about all kinds of different philosophical ideas behind the Joker and anarchy and chaos and what he would represent. And Heath was just ready to do it. He was ready to do something that big. So we went through the process of deal making and announcing and everything. And I think the whole world turned around and said, what are you doing? You know, Heath Ledger, Joker, it didn't make any sense to people at all.
I kind of remember that buzz. I remember it being like, no, that doesn't work. This is Heath Ledger, like rom-com star. What's he doing?
Exactly, because before The Joker, who took Heath Ledger sort of seriously as an actor, whether he deserved it or not? He was 10 Things I Hate About You.
And that's
when Brokeback Mountain come out?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, kind of an outlier in that canon, really. And also,
initially, he was known for those kind of rom-com roles.
And they'd approached him originally to play Batman. They'd said, you know, that's your guy. Get Heath Ledger to play Batman. At that time, that makes more sense than The Joker, but wow, did he reinvent that character brilliantly. And it wasn't just a one-off in terms of The Dark Knight. Nolan's filmography is punctuated with monumental achievements like that, reinventing the genre, as we've mentioned, with each project kind of adds a layer to his legacy. Now, Inception, the elevator pitch on Inception must have been impossible. Came out in 2010. It delved into the intricacies of dreams and realities, and it still earned 4 Academy Awards, leaving an indelible mark on the science fiction genre. Of course, you had DiCaprio in there. You had Elliot Page, Marion Cotillard, Tom Hardy, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Cillian Murphy. All names that have long associations with Nolan. He does love to work with kind of a revolving carousel of similar actors, you know, that he picks them for certainly different roles. He loves working with the same actors, and they appear time and time again in a myriad of Nolan films. No less than Sir Michael Caine. He played Alfred in the Batman trilogy. He was in Interstellar, which we've not got to yet. He's in The Prestige. He's worked with him on 8 films and counting. I'm sure it won't stop there. Here he is on the Interstellar red carpet talking
about... Well, I think he's a genius, you know. I mean, he made 6 hit movies in a row of all different subjects. He not only directs them, he writes them. Usually a great director gets a great writer. I mean, David Lean, he made great movies, but they were written by Robert Bolt, who was a great genius writer. This guy is his own Robert Bolt.
And it seems like he's got you on speed dial.
Oh, yeah.
When he calls, when Christopher Nolan calls Michael Caine, he's there in a heartbeat. Now, we jump forward from Inception to Interstellar. I always get those two mixed up. So 2014, this one explored the vastness of space with a detailed study into what would happen if you fell into a black hole and still managed to weave in an emotional narrative. I mean, that's a tough elevator pitch, and yet it resonated with audiences and critics, even if we were all a little bit confused by it. Matthew McConaughey was a star for that. He talks really warmly about about Christopher Nolan. Here he is talking about what sets Nolan aside from other directors.
I've never worked with a better leader. I cannot say I've ever worked with a better problem solver. And half of the problems he just solves by pure will. He never goes backwards. He won't go reshoot anything, even if you found out something was wrong, I don't think he would reshoot it. Conceptually, he's able to realize things on screen, to actually put them up there in a larger and more awe-inspiring scope than any other director that I know or I've seen. Yet when we were shooting the personal stuff, which this film's full of, it felt like a small independent film. A few takes. He's not a perfectionist. I thought he was going to be a perfectionist. He's not a perfectionist. He actually wants the imperfections. Mm. And you take as much time as you need. But he also has a great sense of humor.
I mean, Matthew McConaughey proving there why he should never wear a leather jacket to an interview. but he did.
He can get away with it.
He can get away with it. It's Matthew McConaughey. We love him. We've talked about Oppenheimer at length, vast and ambitious, to tell the story of the man behind the A-bomb. But there's no action sequences. It manages to home in on the conversations and the emotions of the characters. Oppenheimer, played by Cillian Murphy, another longtime collaborator and produced by his wife, Emma. It's just swept up at the Oscars. And it's got Robert Downey Jr., who was brilliant as the baddie Louis Strauss, his first ever Oscar. Earlier today, Best Supporting Actor, his third time of being nominated. But he, in his speech, thanked the duo behind the film.
Here's my little secret. I needed this job more than it needed me. Chris knew it. Emma made sure that she surrounded me with one of the great casts and crews of all time. Emily, Cillian, Matt Damon, Blunt. It was fantastic, and I stand here before you a better man because of it.
That's quite nice.
Did he reference Emily Blunt twice?
I think he said Emily, and then he said Blunt. I think he got confused with Emma as well. No, we'll forgive him for that.
Which,
it's hard
by
to
the
make
way,
a speech.
Emily Blunt, a lot of fanfare around Cillian's performance and Robert Downey Jr., but she was sensational in that. I know she got nominated, but
yeah, she got nominated, yeah.
I definitely would have thought she'd be worthy of winning as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Again, I wonder if Robert Downey Jr., that would be the first time they work together. I wonder if he will continue to pop up in Nolan's work, because he does like to work with the same sort of people, and it clearly worked for Oppenheimer. Look, we haven't touched on his narrative structure, the way he loves to use music, but essentially, nothing but high praise for Christopher Nolan. I'm looking forward to whatever he does next. I don't even know what he's doing yet, so I'm already looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, definitely great career. He's such an interesting filmmaker. Clearly, everybody that works with him loves him.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting what we heard from Matthew McConaughey about how he's not a perfectionist.
Yes, that surprised me today.
Right? There is something about imperfection that can feel real, that can feel genuine. So, brilliant feature. Thank you so much for that, Rog.
Good stuff, Rog.
The Off-Script Podcast.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please do go ahead and click subscribe. You can also check out our other podcasts, Time Capsule or The Big Interview. You find it wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.